This is Fresh Air. David Dellinger has devoted his life to nonviolent protests against war, racism, and social injustice. He was one of the organizers of some of the largest demonstrations against the war in Vietnam. In 1969, as one of the Chicago Seven, he stood trial on charges of conspiring to riot at the 1968 Democratic National Convention. His critics could hardly blame Dellinger's upbringing for his politics. His parents were conservative Republicans. His grandmother was a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution. Dellinger, like his father, went to Yale. But then David Dellinger's life took a completely different direction. In 1940, while in Union Theological Seminary, he refused to register for military service. That resulted in the first of two prison sentences he served for resisting the draft. His new memoir is called From Yale to Jail. It was in jail that he first tested his nonviolent principles.
When I was in Lewisburg Prison, my second prison term, which was for 2 years, a young fellow came to me one morning, terrified, said that three people had come to his cell the night before to rape him, and that somehow he had staved them off. Maybe the guards, you know, came nearby or something. But anyway, he staved them off, and they said that they're going to be here tonight, and they're going to do it. And I knew I had to help him, and I didn't know how. And I guess I had some desperate idea that maybe if the way the hierarchies worked in prison, that if I challenged the leader and beat him in a fight, that the others would actually allow a fair fight, and then if I won, they would go away.
What happened?
Well, what happened was that I didn't want to fight, but I was prepared to. And so when they came, well, first of all, I had somebody, you know, they have keys that you can get out of your, they had there at least, that you can get out of your cell. And so I had my next door cellmate, I mean, the cell next door, who was a bank robber and had one of those to get me out of my cell at the time that they would come, you know, when the lights were out and the guards went away for a while. And I went down to this fellow's cell, and I stood there, and I got there before they did. And when they came, I said, "Hi, guys, how are you?" You know, or something like that. And I started talking with them. So, you know, I started talking about, you know, I was just up in the hole, and have you guys, I suppose you've been there too. And then I asked them about their raps, you know, what they were in for and so forth, because I was new in that cell block. I'd just been transferred there when that happened. And I did establish something, but there came a time when we'd really become friends, and I told them about some of my experiences and they about theirs and our families and so forth. But they weren't going away, and a couple of the guys, because there were four of them, a couple of them were kind of restless around the edges, and I could see the time might be when they'd say, "Get the F out of the way, you know, we're going in." And so at that point, I said something along these lines. You know, I heard that some people had been threatening to rape my friend Bill, and I came down because, well, I'd already talked about him a little, you know, which I won't repeat now, about what a nice guy he was and how he had been fighting for prisoners' rights and so forth. Because I said, I hate to have anything like that happen to him. And I said, you can be relieved. You can be glad how relieved it... No, now I'm getting it wrong. So I came down here to protect him, and I decided that if somebody came with a shiv, which was a prison knife made in the same machine shops as the keys that I talked about, which and they had had one the previous night. So if somebody came down here, they'd have to stick a shiv into me before they stuck it into him. And I'm so relieved to know that it's you guys and you wouldn't do that. And
were they flattered?
Well, the two that had been restless and hadn't engaged in the conversation much just disappeared. Next thing I knew, they weren't there. And then the second guy left, and so finally the leader, a guy, his name was Steele, and he had the most steely eyes and manner I've ever known. And he said in some swear words, you know, "Holy, I never heard such a thing. You'd let us stick a shiv into you in order to save him. And he just was floored in an admiring way.
Yeah.
And so then we walked away together. And after that, we were all friends, and they never bothered him. And I was just, I wasn't afraid during it when that happened. But as soon as I got into the room, I began to sob. I began to cry and shook all over.
Now, I want to contrast this to a time later in your life when you also tried to use language and principles of nonviolence, and it didn't work. And I'm thinking at a demonstration that you were at where there was a really noisy, aggressive, bullying guy. And how did you handle that? What did you say?
Well, I was up on the step ladder from which we were talking. It was during the Korean War. And I was worried because he was yelling so much. And also, a couple of our supporters had sort of put their arms around him. And I was worried about that maybe they wouldn't be totally nonviolent. So finally, I said, "If you want to hit somebody, I'll come down and you can hit me." But I had not established a proper bond with him. I did it wrong, and so I went down there, and he came rushing at me, and I sidestepped a couple of times, and then I trying to talk to him to establish the bond as I had in prison. And then finally I realized I wasn't living up to my word, so I stood there with my arms to my side, and he hit me. Knocked me out, broke my jaw, and caused an injury to an eye, which right now I'm legally blind, have been for years. Because my eye never recovered from that.
Besides the physical damage that blow caused, did it cause you also to challenge any of your principles or to say, well, I'll never make that offer again. If you want to hit somebody, hit me.
It challenged me to be smarter and to establish a better bond before, because one has to combine common sense with everything else.
My guest is longtime peace activist David Dellinger. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Dellinger. He's written a new memoir called From Yale to Jail, The Life Story of a Moral Dissenter. A lot of the people in the 60s anti-war movement had conflicts with their parents about politics. Did you have conflicts with your parents about politics? Your parents were conservative Republicans.
Yes, I had conflicts with them. When I announced, I was in divinity school when the draft law was passed, and I was exempt if I just signed my name registered. But I thought that was a bribe. You know, some people are religious or can't kill people, and so we will exempt them, but ordinary people will do the real work of society. And when I told my father I was not going to register for the draft, he said he would commit suicide if I didn't do it. So that shows how badly he felt. And I talked to him. It was on the phone. And I talked to him for over an hour when I was convinced that he wouldn't do it. But even with that, we still maintained some kind of, I don't know what to call it, camaraderie or something. But he thought I was throwing my life away by going to prison. And he had transferred some of his ambitions to me, his oldest son.
That's a very, really manipulative thing for a parent to do. I'm going to kill myself if you do this action.
That's right.
Did you feel responsible? Did you feel like, well, in that case, you know, did you feel at all? In that case, well, maybe I should consider registering for the draft. I can't take responsibility for my father.
No, I loved my father, but I don't think I considered not registering. What I considered that my duty was to persuade him not to kill himself, and I would not. And actually, he said to me, if you hang up, I will kill myself immediately. And I talked to him for a long time and was till I was convinced. And I, when our children were growing up and he came to visit us, was one of the things that brought us closer together, because he was always worried, you know, you won't have enough money to send your kids to college or to treat, you know, have them buy them the things they need. And we were very poor by choice, something close to what Dorothy Day called voluntary poverty, although I never quite liked that word. that phrase. And he said, my gosh, your kids are so wonderful, you know. And he loved the fact that we had an organic garden. Even if he was a lawyer, he would have loved to have spent more time in the garden than he was able to. And so step by step, so that by the end of his life, he said to me that he had decided that I had chosen the way of life that he valued and that he thought was right. Hmm. And that was shortly before he died.
You organized some of the largest of the peace demonstrations during the anti-war in Vietnam movement. And I wonder what it was like for you during those demonstrations to be in crowds of tens of thousands of people, feeling responsible for the actions of the crowd. I mean, I think any time you're in a crowd of that size, the crowd has a mind of its own.
Yes.
Can you describe a little bit what it's like to lead a huge demonstration?
Well, first of all, I have to say right off that I did not organize those demonstrations. They were organized by hundreds and then thousands of people all over the country. I happened to be chairman of the National, or co-chairman of the National Mobilization Committee to End the War. But it got to be a problem at the beginning. People, you know, the country hadn't turned against the war yet. And particularly in the early days, you know, people would be criticized by their parents or their children, depending, or their neighbors. You know, it was unpatriotic, and how could they do that? And then they would go to Washington, and there'd be originally 20,000, and then up to 100, 200, whatever. And they couldn't realize that they weren't crazy. You know, and that other people felt the same, so it gave them energy. But in the end, there got to be a stage where people would go there and they'd feel, oh, they wouldn't go back to their community to organize there, you know. But they would say, when is this was marvelous, when will be the next demonstration? And I compared that in my mind with some of the experiences I'd had in the South during civil rights days, when there'd be a mass meeting in a church and everybody would get whipped up and be inspired. But then they wouldn't say, when's the next service or when are we going to have another mass meeting? They would open the doors and go out and face the police clubs and the police dogs and the water hoses and all the rest.
You were one of the organizers of the protest at the Chicago Democratic National Convention. And you were one of the Chicago Seven indicted for conspiring to
Chicago
cause...
Chicago 8
originally, yeah.
Yeah, don't forget Bobby Seale.
No, he was absolutely right.
The most mistreated of us all and with the least justification.
Well, you eight were charged with conspiring to cause a riot. Did that strike you as ironic, Mr. Nonviolent Resistance?
Well, of course it struck me as ironic, but first of all, the conspiring, because I didn't even know some of the other people with whom I was charged of conspiring, including Bobby Seale. None of us knew Bobby Seale. And actually, the prosecutor in his opening statement said that Mr. Dellinger was the architect of the violence that took place. And of course, what they did was to accuse me of pretending to be nonviolent and leading a nonviolent march so it would distract the police while the others went into the center of town and rioted. And it was just a total falsity. Even the presidential commission said it was a police riot.
How has your life changed when the war in Vietnam ended? And the war that you had been organizing against no longer was an issue.
Well, I think I was... First of all, my life wasn't changed that much because it's still an unjust society and my struggle always has been for justice. So, but the way in which it was improved for me, especially after the trial died down, and all that publicity that I hated because it made us look like we were heroes. And anything which, first of all, it's never quite true, you know. One of my son, with my encouragement, changed his name because everywhere he went, you know, people say, oh, are you Dave's So I felt relieved when I got out of that business.
Out of the limelight.
Yes. But also, I always tried to emphasize grassroots. And I lived in a small, intentional community, and I worked in a slum in Newark, for example, working with youth gangs and that kind of thing. And it was with great reluctance that step by step I got pushed to be like chairman or co-chairman of these committees and to speak at the demonstrations. I didn't mind speaking at the demonstrations, but I didn't like the emphasis of some people that all that counted was what happened nationally, because I think that the revolution or decency, whatever you want to say, begins in one's own heart, in one's own life, in one's family, in one's neighborhood, one's place of work. I often quote Charlie Parker, the jazz musician, who says, jazz comes from who you are, where you've been, what you learned. If you haven't lived it, it won't come out of your horn. And I often quote that and say that's the way I believe in about politics. If you don't live it in your own life, it won't come out of your horn.
Dave Dellinger, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
David Dellinger has written a new memoir called From Yale to Jail, The Life Story of a Moral Dissenter. This is Fresh Air.